logical fallacies. There's so many of them, and we're going to talk about some of them today. Welcome to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast. Like I mentioned in the introduction, today we're going to be listening to several of my older podcasts. This is another one of the episodes where, thank you, Seth. Seth has gone ahead and condensed a whole bunch of shorter podcasts that I released, just under 5 years ago, into one episode so that you don't have to hit the download button a million times. But one of the symptoms of that is it will feel like at times we will jump from one subject to the next. It's just a necessary byproduct of doing this type of thing where you're taking older episodes that are much shorter and trying to condense them down and splice them together. It is what it is. Also, you will notice terrible audio. That's what I worked with back in the days. I recorded my first, 200 or 250 of these short podcast episodes on a BlackBerry phone that I know was using the stock headphones that came with that BlackBerry phone. In fact, that very BlackBerry phone is mounted inside of a little glass case that my wife gave me for, my third anniversary of the Youth Apologetics training. I'm looking at it right now. It is a relic, that stinking phone, but it got me through many episodes. I worked on a low budget, and look where God has taken me with that. So there's a lesson there. Hey, if you step out in faith, if you just move forward, if you feel like the Lord is moving you to do something, just go for it. If you don't have what it takes, God's going to fill in the gaps. And so, praise God. I guess on that note, as you listen to some of these old podcasts, I'm a little goofy. My professionalism is not there yet. And I think I had a little bit more fun with the older episodes. And I suppose there might be something I can take away from that. As I'm listening to these old podcasts, I was pretty goofy back then. I had a little bit more fun than I do now. Not that these podcasts aren't fun. I just was a little more, I don't know, dare I say immature in my approach? But I sure did have fun. Sometimes I come off a little abrasive in these older episodes, and I apologize for that. I really have come a long way. Also, there was some comments I made as I was editing this episode. I realized there were some comments I made about the King James Bible. And I made them very much tongue-in-cheek. I actually love the King James Bible. And I think it is the best translation we have in English. I'm not going to go as far as to say I'm a King James onlyist, but I do believe that it is the best translation we have in English. And I have a lot of reasons to believe that that is so. Well, one of the things I brought up in this episode as an argument that is used that technically is a logical fallacy, I actually think, yeah, that the argument is a logical fallacy, but at the same time, I think the merits of the argument still need to be considered. And that would be that all the newer translations have their roots in a Greek translation that two guys, Westcott and Hort, completed. And these two guys were, admittedly, they were occultists. One of them believed in evolution. The other one believed very much so, subscribed to many Roman Catholic beliefs, but both of them were part of a club called the Ghostly Guild, where they communicated with spirits, okay? Well, when you look at some of their old writings, they even claim that when they translated this New Testament into Greek. Again, this Greek New Testament translation is the foundation for most of your newer versions. They even claim that they got assistance, channeled and got assistance from these spirits to translate this Greek New Testament. Now, to say that all the newer translations are then therefore corrupt, there is a logical fallacy in there. But having said that, that is something to consider, right? Stroke your chin. Think on that one. But I said it very tongue-in-cheek in this episode, and after listening to it, I thought, you know, I don't think that came across correctly. I don't think my sarcasm really came through. And so I just wanted to throw that little disclaimer at the beginning of this episode. Look, if you use a different version of the Bible, fine. I got saved reading the NIV. That is the nearly inspired version. Okay? The gospel can be found in all of them. But one of these days, I would love to go down a long trail as to why I prefer the King James Bible. Again, I want to let you guys know, I am not, for the record, I am not a King James onlyist, okay? I'm not saying that somehow the translation is inspired of God. The original autographs certainly are, but I'm not saying that the King James Version translation is, okay? It might have some problems, but I think it's the best one we have. All right? Is there enough legal disclaimers in there for you? I hope so. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into this terrible audio but awesome episode or collection of episodes from the old days, almost 5 years ago, on logical fallacies.
Hi, this is Michael Bohm with Deep Apologetics Training. Today we're going to discuss a logical fallacy, and always when we talk logical fallacies and logic, we're going to give you the dummies version of logic and logical fallacies. We want to keep it as simple as possible. When you guys decide to pursue logic a little further, you can take a course in high school or college. It gets pretty intense, but we're going to keep it simple. Today we're going to talk about equivocation. What is equivocation? Equivocation is basically when somebody is ambiguous in a way that they say something. It's somewhat vague in a way that allows you to interpret what they're saying in multiple ways. And this is done intentionally, and it's done with the intention to deceive. Another way that people refer to equivocation is double speak. So let's get some examples of equivocation. How about this? The word evolution, for example, when you are taught about evolution being a fact in school, they're using equivocation because there are actually six different definitions of the word evolution. And they don't really tell you which one they're talking about, and they expect you to accept all six as fact when, in fact, only one of them is a fact. There are six definitions. One of them is cosmic evolution, the origin of time, space, and matter. That is one definition of evolution. Chemical evolution, the origin of higher elements from hydrogen. Another evolution definition would be stellar. Stellar evolution, sometimes referred to as planetary evolution, which is the origin of stars and planets. Another, organic evolution, the origin of life from inanimate matter. Macro evolution, changing from one kind into another, or one species, but I don't like using the word species because that's a little loose. And then microevolution, the only version of evolution that actually does happen, and that is variations within kinds. For example, you can have many different kinds of dogs, but they're all still dogs. You can have long hair, short hair, and as these dogs breed, you can get different styles of dogs, but the dogs will never cease to be dogs. They're still dogs. That's microevolution. you can hybridize corn until the sun goes down, and farmers do it all the time, but the corn never becomes a banana. It's still corn. It's always corn. Let's look at another example of equivocation. Again, equivocation is an ambiguous statement or phrase or word that can be interpreted multiple ways, and this statement is given with the intent to deceive. How about pro-choice? So people that are talking about being pro-choice are trying to get you to focus on the fact that a woman should have the choice to do what she wants. Well, everybody believes that. They want to have a choice. But what they're not saying and what they really mean is that a woman should be able to kill her child if she wants to. That is an example of equivocation. How about when you hear your president say something about how he wants responsible spending or the like? Our presidents have many different ways of saying basically that same idea, responsible spending. Well, what do they mean by that? Do they mean it's responsible spending when you spend less money than the government is taking in? Or do they mean, let's not worry about how much we're spending, let's make sure we're spending it on social programs and giving free stuff to a lot of people while taking a bunch of money from the responsible people? Maybe that's what they mean. Again, good example of equivocation. So why am I talking about equivocation? Tomorrow we're going to get into an introduction to evolution. And I thought it'd be a good time to talk about equivocation, what it means, and how it's used in evolution, or how it's used in the classroom to teach evolution, and how basically a little sleight of hand, a little trick is being pulled over on our students, and they need to be aware of what is happening. Another logical fallacy, ad hominem. Now, what in the world is an ad hominem? It's a strange word. Basically, what it is a personal attack on an opponent to undermine their argument. So basically, rather than attack the argument that a person is putting forth, they attack the person. Try this one out. This is a little extreme, but it's a little fun as well. You are a homophobic, bigoted, intolerant hater, fundamentalist, who doesn't believe a woman should have the right to choose. Now, I went way off the charts on that one, but you get my point. And I've actually heard somebody say that before. not of me, but I've heard them say that. Nonetheless, what do we have here? Their real issue, their real beef, is they think that a woman should have the right to choose. Rather than deal with your arguments, your reasons why you don't believe a woman should have a right to choose to kill her child, they're just calling you names. This kind of stuff you see on the news, it's a very popular thing to do in politics. Political debates are full of them. Political commercials, which all of us right about now are losing our minds over. I don't even have a TV, and I'm losing my mind over all these political ads. So this ad hominem personal attack, I probably don't even need to tell you why it's wrong, but it is a logical fallacy, and it's obvious that it's wrong. It is a person who has failed to use their brain and think through the issues at hand, the merits of your argument, and rather than trying to think through it or engage you on some kind of intellectual ground, they have chosen to just personally attack you. It shows a lack of character and a lack of thought on their part. So, and also how to recognize this. Well, I don't think I really need to go into that either. It's pretty simple. If they're attacking you or, well, somebody else, their opponent, rather than their argument, that is ad hominem. And again, it is a strong indicator of character and intellectual class. And so let's look at how you can deal with this. There's many ways to deal with this kind of an attack, and Well, a lot of times people just choose to let it go. Sometimes I let it go because, well, Jesus took all kinds of personal attacks. Sometimes he shot back, sometimes he didn't. And you're going to have to let the Holy Spirit guide you on this. There has been some times where I took repeated abuse from somebody and finally decided, you know what, I got to address this. So while they were in front of many of their friends who always laughed when they made these attacks, I asked them a question basically, and I might get the exact quote wrong, but the basic question is, are you attacking me personally because you have failed to think through these issues and you have no intellectual ground to stand on? Or do you actually have something to say intelligent that we can discuss? Other friends were like, oh, and the person felt really stupid. And, well, believe it or not, I think that the Holy Spirit did guide me on that one, because soon after that, they started engaging me and actually listening to what I had to say. And they realize now that personal attacks are a strong indicator of a lack of thought. And I actually believe I helped them in life by bringing this out in the open, because suddenly they thought to themselves, oh gosh, that is what I do. So, you know, every once in a while, it is good to bring it out in front of somebody's face. Otherwise, you might just want to take it. Jesus did take it sometimes. Nonetheless, that is ad hominem. It is wrong. It is a logical fallacy. And when you see it happening on your TV, when your politicians and your news channel start poking fun at somebody, man, that's a good indicator that they have not thought things through, and that most likely whatever their position is, you almost by default don't want to believe. But whatever they do have to say now is in question, because they have chosen to use personal attacks rather than actually engage the topic at hand. The genetic fallacy. What exactly is the genetic fallacy? The genetic fallacy is basically when you dismiss an argument or somebody's opinion because you don't like the source of the argument or opinion. Sometimes people call the genetic fallacy damning the origin. So what does the genetic fallacy look like when it's being used? Have you ever heard anybody say that the gospel, the Christ dying on the cross and staying in the tomb for 3 days and then rising again on December 25th is actually a copy of all kinds of ancient rising God myths, and therefore Christianity is not true because it's a copycat faith? That is an example of the genetic fallacy. Not only, let's just suppose that it's true that all these rising, dying and rising God stories came before Christianity. Let's just imagine that. Would that mean that Christianity copied these myths and it wasn't true? Absolutely not. Now, interestingly enough, tomorrow I'm going to be starting on a series about that very issue, but I thought I'd kick that off with just the whole idea of genetic fallacy. These dying and rising God myths are easily refuted, but even if they were all true, it would not mean that Christianity is false and that it copied them. So can't you see where they made this genetic fallacy mistake by supposing that Christianity is not true because there is other stories that supposedly came before Christianity and had similar themes, and therefore Christianity must have copied it? What about this? There's actually a story out that many people know about a large, or rather Titanic size ship made out of metal that was supposedly unsinkable and went out on its first maiden voyage, hit an iceberg, and sank, killing thousands of people. The story starts with a T. Anybody want to guess the title? It's Titan. No, not Titanic, Titan. And you're thinking, what? Yeah, that's right. There's an old story, a fictional story that came out before the Titanic sank, and it basically told the story of the Titanic before the Titanic sank. So would you conclude from that the Titanic never sank and that it was just merely a story copying the fictional story? No, it's a strange coincidence. Strange indeed, but true. All right, so you guys are starting to get the idea. How about this one? A couple fellows named Westcott and Hort wrote a Greek New Testament that most newer versions of the Bible use. So the NIV and the New Living Translation and the New American Standard and on and on and on. All these Bibles use for their New Testament as one of their sources this Westcott and Hort Greek New Testament. But Westcott and Hort were known occultists. They admitted so much in their own writings. They had a club that they founded called the Ghostly Guild, where they communicated with the dead. They basically, that's called necromancy. They also, one of them believed in evolution. Another one worshipped Mary. So, should we conclude that all the new versions of the Bible are corrupt because Westcott and Hort, their translation was used in these newer versions? That would be committing the genetic fallacy. Just because a couple occultists who spoke to the dead took part in writing this Greek New Testament that is used in the newer versions does not mean that the newer versions are corrupt. Right? Okay, let's move on. So how do you handle a situation where somebody uses the genetic fallacy in an argument? Okay, let's suppose that somebody basically damned one of your arguments because of its source. Maybe it's because it was biblical or whatever. Perhaps we're talking about this whole thing that Jesus is no different than all the other myths, gods like Mithras and Adonis and the like. How would you respond to that situation? Well, I personally would ask them, so what? What do I mean by that? Well, so what if Christianity looks like all of these other myths, it does not mean that it came from the myths. What about the Westcott and Hort thing? So what? Just because Westcott and Hort were occultists and spoke to the dead does not mean they can't make a good Greek translation of the Bible. You see what I'm saying? You can apply this to any genetic fallacy that you hear. You basically say, so what? And put the burden of proof on them, because it doesn't necessarily follow that what they're saying negatively about the source affects the conclusion. The analogical fallacy. It sounds pretty complicated, but it's really not. Let me give you some technical definitions that I found around on the internet, and then I'll just give you the Mike Bohm version. One site says it's the use of analogical comparisons to connect the item in question to another item that has desired characteristics. You can then claim that the first item has the desired property. Another location defined the analogical fallacy this way. It says, the analogical fallacy consists of supposing that things which are similar in one respect must be similar in others. It draws a comparison on the basis of what is known and proceeds to assume that the unknown parts must also be similar. Okay, so what are some examples in the real world? Let's try a really quick, easy one. People are like dogs. They respond best to clear discipline. Okay. Now, the problem with using analogies in an argument is you can't prove anything with them. Now, humans, we like using analogies because it helps us learn. It helps us see things in a way that makes sense. And I'm not against analogies. They're great. They help to illustrate an argument, but they don't prove anything. All right? So what is a common analogy or analogical fallacy that's used against Christianity? Have you guys ever heard the blind men and the elephant analogy concerning religion? Well, here it goes. It goes something like this. You got four blind men, and they discover an elephant. The men have never seen an elephant. They've never really encountered an elephant, so they approach the elephant, and they kind of start feeling around, and they're trying to figure out what this thing is. One grabs a hold of the trunk and figures out that it must be a snake. Another is feeling around, and he finds the legs and describes it as a tree. A third finds the elephant's tail and tells everybody it's a rope. And the fourth blind man discovers the elephant's side and concludes that he's found a wall. They're all describing the same elephant, yet each describes the same thing in a completely different way. And so, logically, it follows that religion is just like that, in that we're all blindly groping around in the dark, trying to figure out who this God is, and we all are feeling different aspects or parts of him, but we just don't have the whole thing figured out. Okay? And that's how people, one of the ways that people use the false analogy to promote this religious pluralism idea. So being that they use an analogy to illustrate this whole thing, let's break down the analogy and see how it's false. And this works the same way with all analogies. They always fall short. They always fall short to a certain extent. Let's look at this analogy. First, we need to point out that what the blind men are describing is an elephant. It's not anything else. It's not anything other than an elephant. And likewise, Christianity is describing a real, all-powerful, all-knowing, and everywhere present God who created the heavens and the earth. He's a real God. But then you look at all the other faiths, and they describe something completely and totally contrary to that. Again, this totally breaks down in the elephant analogy. All of our views of what is or isn't God are completely different. The second way that this breaks down is, it's kind of funny, nobody seems to catch this. All the blind men perceive something like a rope, a wall, different things like that, but what people miss is not a single one of them get it right. Not a single one say it's an elephant. And that completely breaks down the analogy all by itself right there. And lastly, this analogy doesn't take into account any kind of special revelation concerning this elephant. There's no real knowledge of this elephant that we're being given. If a man walked into the room and actually had eyes to see, all these four blind men would be blown away, because he would go in there and he would say things like, well, first of all, this is an elephant, and it's a big elephant. This elephant looks like it's had a bit much to eat. It's a little overweight. In fact, if it stepped on you, you would be deeply impressed. Just kidding. It apparently had too much heat earlier today and has left some byproduct there at your feet. You might want to watch out for that. And you know what I'm saying? It completely misses the idea that a faith can have special revelation about this God. It assumes that this God, or elephant, is doing nothing to reveal itself. Okay, so anyway, just to move on here, the whole idea is an analogy can't be used to prove anything. It just helps us illustrate concepts, and it should always be seen as such. You can't hear somebody give an analogy and then run with that and use that as some kind of a proof statement, which, you know, these analogies, they all come in varying shapes and sizes. and are pushed in varying degrees. Some of them, it's pretty obvious, they're just making a comparison, no big deal, helps you see an example. But others use it as an argument. President Barack Obama said recently, and boy, if my wife was here right now, I'd be getting a shoulder punch. I shouldn't be talking about politics on this show. Anyway, that's how it works when you're married. He said recently concerning this universal health care, he says, that's why under my plan, individuals will be required to carry basic health insurance just as most states require you to carry auto insurance. All right, there's the false analogy. Likewise, businesses will be required to either offer their workers health care or chip in to help cover the cost of their workers. All right, anybody see some problems with that analogy? First of all, not all people have cars. A lot of people choose not to have cars. A lot of people choose to bike or ride to work in a bus or, well, whatever they want to do, skateboard, I don't know. So not all people have cars. Secondly, car insurance is, most of the time, its main purpose is to cover the other person, the other person's car, the other person's injuries, if you're the one that's at fault. It's basically to insure other people on the road so you don't get jacked. In the case of health insurance, if you choose to take poor care of yourself or if you put yourself in harm's way, you're not jacking anybody else, you're jacking yourself. So why does everybody else have to pay for that? And lastly, yeah, that kind of springboards right into the next point. Every person is basically responsible for their own car, right? So why, in this healthcare situation, should everybody have to pay for your car? If you take poor care of your car and you don't change your oil for 50,000 miles and your engine gives up and blows up, that's your fault. And why should everybody else have to pay for it? If you eat Big Macs all day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you turn into a morbidly obese individual and then your heart gives out, why should everybody else have to pay for it? And see, now I'd really be getting lots of shoulder punches because I just kept going. And my wife would be like, I punched you once, you didn't get it, and you just kept talking. And I hear I'm still going, so I'm going to stop. I'm just going to stop. This isn't a politics show. This is Youth Apologetics Training. And I'm Michael Bohm, and I'm going to stop right now. Thanks for listening, guys. Hopefully I've given you a good idea of what this analogical fallacy is. And tomorrow we'll get into religious pluralism and how it ties in, because that's one of the main things that they like to use is false analogies, and they've got a whole bunch of them. So we'll discuss more false analogies tomorrow, but in a different context. Come on to the website, youthapologeticstraining.com, and if you have any questions, I would love to hear them. If you have suggestions for future shows, if you want to tell me that I stink, that's cool too. And catch me on Facebook as well. I'd like to be your friend.
Well, all right. We'll stop right there. That's it. So thanks, guys. Thank you for listening. This has been Michael Bohm, Youth Apologetics Training. I love you guys. And we'll see you next week. Sing it out loud.